Please pull up a seat and wind down. Was your sojourn on Rokkanjima a pleasant one? The Witch of Theatre Going has invited you to a tea party. We hope you choose to attend.
Hello, and welcome to a hidden tea party. My name is Courtney. I am the Witch of Video Games, and these are my guests.
Hello, my name is Jess, my pronouns are they, them, and I am one of only two people who won't have Beatrice shoes by the end of next week.
Incredible.
We had to start this podcast like immediately upon discovering this because we needed you to know.
So Courtney is getting Beato shoes.
So yeah, I was gifted by my wonderful mother the gift of custom Vans, and so I designed beautiful Beatrice shoes because there was nothing stopping me from doing that. There will be pictures as soon as I get my hands on them.
They're not going to be here before the episode comes out, so you can't attach it to... Because Spotify...
I can attach the preview of them, but I can't attach what they actually look like. They look good, though. I think they should sell them.
I can't believe it's already been established that Beatrice is into feet, and then you're going to put a picture of her on footwear.
Oh, okay, it's not a picture of her. It's just golden butterflies.
Okay.
I wanted to keep it like subtle, but it's like, it's giving Beatrice.
I don't know why I expected it was just going to be, I thought it was just going to be Beatrice's like mad, like weird creepy face on the side of shoes.
So I didn't know, because you're not supposed to put like copyrighted images onto the shoes. So I didn't know how like thorough they'd be with checking it. And also, if I was going to do that, what I would do is I'd get the ones that Ryukishi drew and just, like, stack them side by side or, like, maybe collage just the best of his Beatrice faces.
That's incredible.
An artistic genius. Truly one of the greatest innovators of our time.
Iconic.
Rowan, did you introduce yourself?
I did not. Hi, my name's Rowan. My pronouns are they, them. I apologize to any sharp-eared listeners. I'm recovering from a cold. That's why I sound kind of sexy this week. You've got to deal with it.
Not as sexy with someone with golden butterflies on their toes, though.
No, I...
Don't like that! Really don't like that! Don't like when you phrase it like that!
That's what's happening, though, is it? You've done this.
You've got beer toes.
Beatrice! I can't believe we've not done that before. That's horrible.
Neither can I.
I've been keeping that.
Wow.
I can think of some really, really cursed images that you could create based off that phrase, and I won't be doing it because absolutely not.
I wouldn't
little
do that
nail
to you.
Arts of all the Beatrice like sprite faces.
one nail for each different Beatrice, you're gonna run out. We're on our toes.
We need AI. We need Kinzo
to fit that mouth of Beatrice's in.
I hate this. Cool.
Incredible.
What a good start.
I know.
To this episode. Off to a great, great start. This week we read chapter 5 of Higurashi, and I cried the whole time.
Stop it!
Okie dokie, and I started a timer when we began the episode, because Courtney said explicitly before we began recording, I'm not going to mention Higurashi this week, and she managed 3 minutes and 55 seconds from the clap until she mentioned Higurashi.
I'm so proud of me. Oh, speaking of the clap, I accidentally uploaded the wrong audio last week. Sorry about that.
So funny.
Briefly heard.
Professional podcast. We are not professional podcast.
I'm amazed. It's the first time I did this. It took like 35 episodes for me to do that.
For anybody who didn't hear it, it was just Courtney's audio. So it started with 2 seconds of silence and then Courtney laughing and saying, "What did you say?" I messaged it to you because it was so fucking funny.
Oh, Courtney will like you if you're a Nazi and burn
past. Yeah, that was it. And then just a good 10 seconds of silence afterwards. And I was like, Courtney, I don't think this is the right audio.
So what happened was, because I put out an Adam bonus episode, I'd saved the actual episode in the Adam folder and uploaded my audio instead. So, I'm a genius.
Courtney
again,
does
incredible.
Start most episodes by saying this, and then she cuts that out of the
episode. Yeah. I'm always talking about Nazis who burn pasta, and like, it's been really weird, and then it showed up in the VN, and I think my co-host realized what I was on about, so.
It's like her Sharpay Evans warm-up. Instead of going like, blah, 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 mah, 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 she's just like, yeah, no, Courtney will love you if you're a Nazi who burns pasta. Every week.
Every week.
And now we finally understand why.
Oh dear.
Please, but before anyone cuts me further, this is a joke. I don't actually talk that much about Nazis who burn pasta.
It was just Courtney, that one.
Courtney is holding up a sign which says, "Everything I'm saying right now doesn't count." She's lying. Courtney's 100% serious about this.
Oh, also, this episode's going to be a pain to come up with a title for, because we've done the trilogy. The trilogy is complete.
We have, Rowan, yeah. We're going to have
Courtney
to
Jess.
We're going to have to start having ideas again.
Oh, damn it.
Hate us.
Especially since, as we know from last episode, Jess has no idea.
No, I actually have quite a few ideas for this one, so...
Oh, this one's an interesting one.
Yeah, what did we read, Courtney?
What we read, for real this time, we read Chapter 9, A New Life, to the end of Chapter 12, New Days.
Still everything very new.
Yeah.
Yes. So new.
One thing I didn't bring up last week that I want to mention right off the bat. I don't know if it was clear to people listening to the podcast, but I hadn't really clicked the, like, Leon is Jess and no.
You mean
hello,
Shannon.
Me?
No, not my,
I'm
not
in the
my
book.
Fucking co-host. You're also answering. Fuck me. I hadn't clicked that Leon was Shikana.
I hadn't really fully until I said it either. Yeah. And then I was like, oh no, yeah, that's exactly what this is.
I don't know if it was audible. Which threw me so far that I did not say any of the things I'd written down. The thing I'd written down, by the way, is Lion is Voldemort.
Okay.
Which I think is now just sort of my response to sort of any rape, baby. Since discovering that was Voldemort's backstory, is that
oh yeah, I mean,
of love because he's the child of rape. I just, like, I'm so horrified by that decision that J.K. Rowling has made. That I now sort of like any. I was just like, oh yeah. Beato's the villain, and also, well,
I think it tracks for recent decisions that J.K. Rowling's made, to be honest.
I think definitely Rika Shea does a lot more with this concept than J.K. Rowling does, because as we know, Shikanan did not grow up as a baby psychopath from this reading, so
yeah. Willing to admit that Ryukishi is a better writer than J.K. Rowling, that's ground I'm willing to concede. Secondly, do we know if J.K. Rowling's pro-abortion? Is that a thing?
I don't know. Do we care?
I think she is.
Okay. I was going to say, because that's a real interesting turn of hers.
It's not her highest priority. Also, I love how you say, like, pro-abortion and not pro-choice.
Really. It's J.K. Rowling. Well, you know. Because, like, TERFs tend to be, like, it tends to go hand in hand as, like, oh, we're going to, like, control people's ability to birth because that's, like, what we believe is the most important thing about them. And so that tends to sort of start hand in hand, which was a really... I'm sorry to do Harry Potter corner. I just had a sudden moment of, like, if she was anti-abortion.
It's fine. It's fine. We're still going to do a pod episode on the Half-Blood Prince movie and how green it is.
It's my favourite Harry Potter film.
It's not a good movie. It's very fun.
It's not a good movie. I just love Punished Draco Malfoy.
I'm glad to know that.
I don't know what to do with any of this, honestly.
I'm so sorry. I really should.
Let's put all of that back in the box.
I saw that Courtney was getting cancelled and I was like, hold my fucking beer.
Yeah, you don't want to be one-upped, do you?
God. Right.
After that, 10 minutes of faffing around, we did some reading.
We did, in fact, read the book this week.
I know. And it starts with a new character, because we're not done.
It does, new OC. It starts with a stage.
Yeah, like a nice little theatre.
I believe we do get this character's name immediately in, like, the, like, character menu.
Yeah. A lot of what's in the character menu doesn't really line up with what we're actually given in the text yet, at least.
Yes.
But yeah. Do we have pronouns for this character?
This character is called Clairvaux Bernardus, and she is generally used because it's, like, officially this character is female, so the fandom tends to just default to she. I know not all people identify as female use she pronouns, but, you know.
She's got a cool, kind of nice look going on. It's kind of like a very pale green, creamy, pastel Lolita thing happening.
Yes, yeah.
It's okay. Knowing it's a bit different.
This is probably a real Lolita dress. Most of the, like, dresses in Umineko Echo are based on real dresses that he saw and was like, I'm going to put this in the VN.
Yeah, I don't fully know how I feel about this design. It's definitely not my personal taste. Sorry, I'm having a look at pictures right now. It's definitely
There's some real clunky boots going on as well that I can't tell if it makes it a serve or I kind of hate.
I think the issue I'm really having is with the sort of, like, top section with the, like, it's almost like the thing you would put on an ill dog to stop them scratching themselves that she's got around her waist. It's like really plasticky looking corset detail. And then just sort of like a bib, I guess. It reads very sort of Bo Peep, very sort of like nappy core.
It does read like a bib. I don't like that.
I feel appreciative of the fact we don't have sort of like fanny frills or any interesting like cutouts and stuff. Like it's just the outfit defies sort of physics in some ways that I find particularly upsetting.
Wait, how does it defy physics?
So the way that the sort of skirt is structured just doesn't make sense. Like, why? How is it staying as stuck out as it is?
Wait, is it? I assumed it was like a hoop skirt. Underneath.
Right, but where's the hoop? And why is there a fold at the side if it's got a hoop?
It's just hidden underneath the skirt.
Secret hoop.
So the center section of the skirt, there's a hoop around there. But then why does the bottom of the big skirt stick out so much? Why is there a fold in the side?
I'm hearing you have a lot of questions.
I think it is doable. I think I don't know if it would fold in that way though.
I am my thoughts on
this.
Yeah, let us know. My thoughts on this, given that she's appearing in a theater with Zeppar and Furfur, who also turn up, is that she has no basis in reality. And I feel like demon clothes, maybe we can give a bit more slack. Demon, witches, I don't know.
No,
we don't. She does not tell us who she is.
If I'm giving Gap's outfit a pass, which I don't know that I am, but if you were to allow Gap's outfit to exist, this must also
be fine. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, they do a lot of talking in this first bit, being like, who am I? Where am I? Does it matter if people around me are kind? And you're just, I am one but many. And you're like, I don't know what you're talking about or who you're supposed to be.
So,
sorry.
Her profile says that technically she is a vessel to personify Beato and her game. Therefore, she has no personality of her own. In that sense, perhaps she is not a person, but a tool.
Yeah, and I don't really know what that meant at this point.
I had more out for a review, but I've decided that's done.
I kind of got, after they were talking for a little while, that they were probably talking about Shikanan, because they mentioned an orphanage at some point, and I was like, okay, so is this, like, we're going to get some Shikanan backstory here. Is it these three who are going to be telling it as a story, or are they just commentating on it, or...
It's kind of a bit of both.
Yeah. So my guess on this was that, like, Claire ends up being kind of a narrator.
We kind of then get a... Okay, so because of how this works, we keep cutting between the stage play and then some flashback sort of type stuff. It's definitely got some artistic license in these flashbacks.
Yeah.
These definitely did not happen as presented. Just to get that out of the way.
There's some witch truth things happening,
yes,
I suspect.
Yes, definitely. It's the first day of this character in the Ushurimiya mansion.
Sorry, interestingly, when, like, we get a lot from Battler's perspective, for instance, in, like, a lot of the previous things, but we often see, like, we'll see his sprite and talking to people, and then we'll get a bit of his thought process and stuff. For throughout all of these flashbacks, we never get a sprite to tell us, like, what the person who is narrating actually looks like, which I think is important.
Yes, it is. Also, all the servants kind of being getting an induction to the house, but the older ones are really confused as to why this literal child is here, this 6-year-old child.
Which is really funny because all of the older servants look like the Stakes.
Yes, they do. specifically, we've got Lucifer, we've got Leviathan, and we've got Satan.
I really appreciated this because I have seen around on the internet images of the Stakes in maid outfits, and I had just thought that was sort of like anime brain rot, and I'm pleased to hear that there was a reason this. I mean, it's still anime brain rot. It's just
I'm curious as to whether this has any actual meaning, like whether they were just like, are the designs of the Stakes based off these servants? What other connections might there be? I'm not sure. But it is quite funny that Lucifer's just there in a little maid hat.
Also there is Shannon as she looks now, which, as we know, is impossible.
Because it's 1976.
Yeah. So, what's more... Okay, so immediately when I first read this, which is why I'm comfortable saying it, is I assumed that, like, this was, like, an imaginary friend. essentially. That the Shakanan child had sort of taken their servant name and created this imaginary friend who was like all the things that they weren't.
Interestingly, so I didn't see it that way. I've been, this is a theory that I'd kind of wondered about whether it was going to go this way anyway, for the whole Shannon canon situation. But like a lot of things that happen in this reading, I'll point out other ones of them as well. I was like, time to diagnose this child.
I really appreciate that from you.
I was like, I'm diagnosing this child with dissociative identity disorder immediately. That's basically, I think, I don't know if people still use the term multiple personality disorder, but DID is, it's the same thing, basically. And I feel I have a small amount of authority to speak on this, in that I don't have DID, but I do have a dissociative disorder. So there's some level of overlap with what's going on with me as well. So I've read a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because, like, you've developed DID as a young child experiencing trauma, which I think we can all probably assume that Shakanan has in an orphanage. With everything that's gone on. Shannon's really like being held up here as like a protector kind of figure. She's a friend, but she's also like trying to reassure this kid that like everything will be okay and stuff. So I'm like, okay, like she's the she's like the sole friend that's been created, but is also a part of this person. I'm interested by how this is going to play out based on Ryukishi's past as a social worker. He's probably worked with a lot of real life kids with this. And so I'm hoping he'll do it well. Is basically what I'm going for. I'm wondering here.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but because dissociative, like, stuff often occurs because of a traumatic event, it's like quite often sort of a way of compartmentalizing and dealing with the trauma.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense for one of the personalities that arises, I don't know if personality is the right word, but one of the personalities that arises to be sort of a protective, perhaps more practical, older even feeling, mature figure who's able to deal with the immediate parts of the trauma and the immediate parts of everyday life, so that the sort of inner child or whatever other emotions and stuff could be shielded somewhat.
I think protector parts are definitely a big thing. It's interesting in that it's not clear whether Shannon takes over at any point. In this bit of the reading anyway. She's kind of positioned as more of a kind of an outside. She's taking a back seat to all of this at the moment. It's just there's just lots of little clues in this that she's not real. I think they mentioned that Shannon and Shakanan share a room. And they say it several times. It's like, oh, all of the other servants have three bedrooms. And they say multiple times that Shakanan doesn't. But they never say how many beds are in the room. Yeah. Because it's only one. I'm like, oh. And no one else seems to really interact with Shannon that much either.
Yeah, there are a couple of, like, small interactions, but it's never anything super meaningful.
Yeah.
I think there's a moment, I don't know if this is jumping ahead a bit, involving a key where, like, they're all sort of in a group and Shannon sort of says something and nobody really reacts to it. And I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the whole presence of Shannon throughout this.
And Shannon's also clearly completely idealized by this person as well. Like, the Shannon that we know's, like, constantly being told off for being a bit, like, hesitant and clumsy and doing things wrong, but this Shannon is, like, Shannon's like, oh, Shannon's amazing, she does everything right, she's super popular, she's really confident. And I'm like, okay, the... that's clearly not the Shannon we know, bless her.
Yeah.
We basically get some backstory about the hiring of this child. Because we've been talking about this for a while. We've been like, it's really weird they'd hire a six-year-old. And apparently Nancy and Kraus thought so.
Yeah, they were like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. But Genji was the one who organized the servants.
Yes.
And Genji wanted Kinzo's child to grow up in Kinzo's house, but he didn't want Kinzo to know. So he basically fudged the ages so that because Shikanon was quite a small child, they could sort of pass for being like six instead of nine. So that's what he did, basically. They were raised 3 years younger than they actually were and brought in as a servant.
I don't understand why this is helpful, though, for them hiring the child.
I think it's basically... So it's really confusing reading this because, like, Will pops in unexpectedly and basically says, like, oh yeah, this was all planned by Genji. And I was like, why did you think that? Like, why? What would make you assume that Kinzo didn't know about his own fucking servant? It turns out he didn't, but I have no idea how Will sussed that out. But yeah, it was basically like Genji wanted to get this kid into the house anyway, but he didn't want Kinzo to find out that it was his child. So he was like, oh, he might be a bit sus if we bring in a really young kid who just happens to be exactly the same age as Kinzo's own kid would have been. So we'll fudge the ages. So he can't be like, oh, it can't be my child because they're 3 years too young.
Completely, completely normal if they'd hired a nine-year-old.
Yeah, I know. But Kinzo doesn't give a shit, does he? Also really funny because Natsumi and Kraus were there being like, why the fuck have they hired someone this young? Is it so that, because Shikanon was around Jessica's age, they were like, is it so that Jessica can have a playmate? But then wouldn't Kinzo have asked us about this? And I was like, Kinzo's never been that nice about anything. You can take that off the table right now. Like,
yeah.
He's never, absolutely that thought has never job. Even crossed his tiny brain. Like, absolutely that's not. But yeah.
So yeah, that's the sort of kind of backstory around this child, who we find out is referred to by the other servants as a Yasu.
Mm.
Which is a name that they hate. It's based on their, I guess, fake surname of Yasuda.
Yeah.
So.
The other servants absolutely hate this, well, what they think is a six-year-old. And it is established as well that usually the other servants they get, they're not old by any means. They're about, I think it was like 16 to 18 are usually the age of the other servants. But, like, all of these 16 and 18-year-olds are like, fucking despise this six-year-old.
They're so pressed.
Six-year-olds can't do their work properly. Ugh.
And like, six-year-old is being paid the same amount as us to go to school and can't even do the work properly. I'm like, and you're hating the six-year-old for that. I'm like, there's some real problems going on here. It's also established that Natsui is in charge of taking this child to Najima to do schooling every day. Or, like, on weekdays or whatever. And I'm like, how on earth did they swing that? Like, How did they manage to get Natsui, of all people, to, like, escort a servant around? Like, she's too proud for that.
She has already tried to kill
and doesn't know. Like, what?
Thanks, buddy.
This is, like, this is one of the funniest outcomes of Natsuhi's various murder plots, in my opinion.
God. It's so complicated. It's unbelievable.
It's very funny that she basically almost always tries to kill this child and then almost always ends up having to look after them anyway.
Mm.
For the audio listeners, Jess is looking disgusted.
Yeah.
You are having a time with it.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. I think this is also the point where, like, in the theater section, Genji and Nanjo get their turn to have a chat about what the fuck was going on with all of this. And Genji's like, oh, here's the backstory of why I know everything.
Yeah. Mm. I'm I'll be honest, I'm like, Nanjo, I've fallen out with you. You got cancelled the other week. You're no longer my favourite. I'm no longer a Stanjo. I'm sorry.
Oh.
End of an era.
Sad.
Press the control
sad.
Button. Sorry,
but
buddy.
Like, yeah, so like, this is what Will apparently worked out, even though I have no idea what evidence he was using for it. But yeah, like, when Natsui pushed the baby off the cliff, Genji was one of the first people he was told. So he, like, ran to the scene of the crime, found the bodies, couldn't tell if they were dead or not, and then rang Nanjo, because he was like, Nanjo's done secret shady stuff for us before, it's time to get him in again. Mm-hmm. And so we brought them to Nanjo, and Nanjo was like, oh, the kid's alive but, like, really wounded, so I'll heal them. And then Genji was like, I'm gonna put this baby in the orphanage and tell Kinzo it's dead.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so it does make sense, because in the sense that Kinzo, like, seemed to really believe the baby was dead.
What really confuses me then is we saw, the first time we got this story, we saw a version of Kinzo who, when Natsui was like, yeah, like, the baby's unfortunately dead, Kinzo was like, haha, I knew that would happen, and just started laughing. If he knew, which he presumably did, that that was his child with Beatrice, why did he react like that?
I think he was just like, it was not like a, like, maniacal laugh, but like a, oh, the universe fucking hates me laugh. Mm. Like a laugh of resignation.
It's hard to tell with him, honestly.
Yeah. But I think he was just like, of course. Of course I can't have this. And I'm like, yeah, you don't fucking deserve it.
Oh, that, and also, you gave a baby to Natsui. What were you doing?
Yeah, so I loved the theory you guys came up with that Kinzo did it on purpose to get rid of the baby. No, sadly, he genuinely thought she was the right woman for the job.
I think it makes more sense with their motivations if he tried to get rid of that baby, but, like, maybe he's just a bit of an idiot, what can we say?
I mean, how well do you think he really knew Natsuhi?
That's true. He doesn't give a shit, does he?
Yeah, he doesn't really. He's not really that interested in her.
Insane.
Badly.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Yeah, he probably was just like, oh, Natsui wanted a kid. Here's a kid. There's no problems there.
Because in theory, Umineko is solvable. In theory, it makes sense that Will has managed to extrapolate this from the evidence that we had.
Mm.
But, like, if he could show his work in, that would be nice.
Yeah, I would love to, like, have seen that particular jump. I just think it came out of left field for me. Because there was not a single moment that I assumed that anyone would have got something past Kinzo. And also, I was very confused at first as to why Genji would do something underhand that his master, who he was so loyal to, didn't know about. He does give his reasoning for this, and it's fairly good reasoning, I suppose. Trigger warning time again, my friends.
Yeah, this whole episode's gonna be trigger warning.
Yeah, it's bad. But yeah, like, so Nanjo and Genji looking at this little kid being like, oh, this is this is the child of incest and rape. That's not very good. What if he does it again? Shit. So, like, I guess at least at this point, they did something, which was, you know, hide the child. But, like, they also really dig themselves a deeper hole when they're describing this, because both of them basically say that, like, Kinzo had at least somewhat confided in both of them how he was feeling about the whole having a daughter who looked exactly like his previous mistress thing. And, you know, wanting to have sex with her and stuff. And they basically just went, don't do that. And then walked off. As if that was ever, like, enough action for this situation. And it said, like, Genji also said, like, that the younger Beatrice also confided in him her confusion about everything. And he never told her, like, what kind of situation she was in or what danger she was in either. So it was like, I guess, like, hiding the child is, like, a good deed at the end of a whole lot of really horrible inaction. Yeah, I'm just like, you really should have stepped in before this child was ever created. Like, that would have been the thing to do.
Insane decision to put the child in the same house as Kinzo.
Also in the orphanage that Kinzo controls. Like,
buddy.
I mean, kind of what else was he supposed to do in his position?
A.N. Other orphanage to begin with.
Honestly, yeah, I kind of feel like...
I guess he wanted to keep tabs on the child, though.
Yeah.
Another way. Do that via letters.
Yeah.
Go visit it on your days off.
I guess also it was the best way for there not to be any questions.
Yeah, I think it. I think
it's another
it
orphanage.
Was...
They might be like, "Okay, why are you giving away this child? Why aren't you looking after?"
Honestly,
it?
I think this kid would have been better off if Genji just like put them in a basket and left them in the middle of a street somewhere. I think they'd have grown up with a better life than this.
I think
that is a different.
I can
kind of
get Genji's
backstory.
Intentions. I don't think they were correct.
Yeah,
but he's in a very tricky position here.
He is in a tricky position, like at least mostly of his own making, because he's not willing to leave this job or upset Kinzo.
Yeah.
I want to see the slice of life anime where Genji and Nanjo leave employment from the Yusuromiyas
and raise this baby
their own. Yes! That would slap.
That's the best timeline. No, there's
that's actually the only timeline at the end of Umanako.
Yeah, that exists anymore.
Ending that they got.
I mean, I suppose for me, I always interpret it as they, like, at the end of the day, they'd rather have the loyalty of this rich man than do the right thing.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think is a bit, is an indictment on them.
Definitely.
Again, you know, you can, without love, it cannot be seen. You could have more love for these characters than that, but you could say it's out of friendship. But I do think at the end of the day, the amount of power that Kinzo has just warps the morals of the people around him.
That fits with the themes of the thing.
It's weird as well, because like Genji says at least something about how he wanted the kid in the house. He didn't want Kinzo to know that this child was his kid, but was like hoping that they would see a similarity or like bond over something and that there would be some like fatherly connection there and stuff. And I was like, I don't know what kind of thing. I don't know what made Genji think that Kinzo was like that with any of his servants or paid attention to them in any way. But like that was never going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
and it
Genji
shouldn't
Kinzo
have.
Aside,
also, like...
Even Genji, the dude who is supposed to be Kinzo's, like, closest companion, is still treated with complete contempt and derision and humiliation. Why would the exception be made? Like, blood of the covenant is thicker than water of the womb. This
I mean,
shit would
have
not.
We, I suppose, have we had much, have we seen much Genji and Kinzo interaction?
Quite a lot at the start, right? Where they were like...
No, but that wasn't Kinzo.
Yeah, no real stuff, really.
No, we haven't seen much with real Kinzo.
So the scene, the very first scene in Umineko, when Kinzo and Genji and Nanjo are all hanging out, and they're playing chess and stuff, is that real?
No.
Okay, I can say with pretty certainty now, down the this, that scene is not real.
Because they're talking about how Kinzo's going to die soon and stuff, and it was, they all say when they find out that he is dead that it was completely sudden and none of them knew it was going to happen.
Gotcha, okay.
So yeah, I don't think we've ever seen Genji and Kinzo interact.
We haven't seen much of Kinzo really interact with anyone. We've had the Ava flashback where he's like mean to her.
We've seen Kinzo and his own daughter, which...
Yeah.
And we've seen young Kinzo.
Yes. And we've also... We have brief Natsuki Kinzo interactions where he just kind of doesn't really talk to her.
Yeah. I guess, like, it's extrapolating kind of off the fake Genji Nanjo thing, Genji Kinzo things we've had, and also how Genji interacts with the rest of the family. It would track if he was also like super loyal to Kinzo. I mean, he has to be at least very loyal to Kinzo to not tell anybody about the whole daughter situation, or he just didn't care that much. I don't know, maybe I'm giving him too much credit there, but
Kuwadorian really is like a black cloud hovering over like now a good like third of the cast of this novel.
yeah it is.
God, the entire plot consumed now by the fact that these people are like horrible. I guess this is the themes of Umineko.
I guess these
do be the themes coming back around. I just don't know how we were supposed to guess this one in advance.
We were supposed to have no love for these characters.
Yeah, actually the way we figure it all out is without love.
The worst that Faith takes, basically. Speaking of bad takes, Burncastle makes an absolutely fucking dreadful one immediately after this conversation.
Oh yeah, Burncastle's just at her worst.
She's just like, oh, Leon, because Leon's like, oh my god, that was like, that's horrendous. And Burncastle's just like, oh, should we look for a fragment where Kinzo sees you as the new Beatrice and does it and makes the same mistake again? And Leon's like, what the fuck? Because what the fuck?
Insane. Absolutely insane decisions. Someone had to write this. Someone had to decide this.
Say someone, like we don't know the person who wrote this.
Yeah. But yeah, it very much cements Burncastle. Like, we knew Burncastle was completely evil, but like, yeah. She's really just like digging further down every time we talk to her at this point, isn't she?
Yeah, reminder that Ryukishi made her that way. Reminder that he decided to make this way.
Yeah. I don't think that's like necessarily the worst. Like she's not portrayed as a good character.
Yeah. This isn't like we're not supposed to be sympathizing with Burncastle.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is particularly out of character for her either.
No.
That's fun.
Yay! What happens next?
We get more flashbacks. This time, it's a specific incident inside the chapel.
Oh, yeah. We get to see in the chapel properly, like, without corpses in it.
A full kind of chapel thing. So, I think the name I'm going to go for this character is the common fandom name, which is Sayo, which is, like, sort of their given name.
Oh, so instead of Yasu,
Yasu, yeah.
Because they have said they hate that.
Yeah, so I'm going to respect that they hate that. I'm going to go with Sayo. Everyone's been cleaning the chapel, but they can't find, they're the only ones who who can't find a small broom that they were using to clean. So they're running around the chapel trying to find it, and they can't.
Because the stake servants were being dicks about it.
Yeah. And then they sort of imagine that it's like a witch moving it around. And this is where we first meet the witch, Beatrice. Except she looks quite a bit different.
I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, new Beatrice, because it's just Gap, but she's called Beatrice now. So I'm like, okay, Gaptrice, hello.
She's called Beatrice. She talks in the way that Beatrice does, rather than the way Gap usually does. So with Beatrice's pronouns. Mm. Yeah, yeah, you've got half a dress and pronouns.
Yeah.
And they sort of become friends over this sort of mutual acknowledgement of each other.
Yeah.
And then at the end, they find that the broom was outside the chapel the whole time. So what probably happened was this was like a really mean prank by the order servants. But instead... Sayo just sort of took it and created the scenario with the witch.
There's a lot of things going on in this scene that's really interesting, I think, because Sayo talks a lot about how they lose things constantly, and there's times where they put stuff down and then go, oh yeah, I must have left it somewhere, and find it. And then there's times where they remember precisely where they've put it down and it's just gone. And they're like, yeah. I can tell which ones are me and which ones are the witch. And the witch is moving stuff away from me, like the whole Gap black hole thing, which is what they conclude is happening in this church, that they're running around every windowsill, and that they think that every time they check one, the little broom is being moved through a black hole to a different one so that they're never going to find it. Which I think is really interesting, especially because trauma causes memory problems. And DID is characterized by amnesia when you switch between different parts of yourself and stuff. So I was wondering whether that was also, like, whether what actually is happening is that there are some times where Sayo just puts stuff down and then comes back to it. And then there's times where Sayo puts up the stuff down, switches into a different personality or part or whatever, moves it. And then when they switch back, they don't know where they've put it because it was a different part controlling them. Which I think, from my research, is a fairly common thing that happens. But then there's also evidence that the other servants are playing tricks on them as well. So like there's a lot going on here. I don't know how much is trauma and how much is just the other servants gaslighting them constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, it said we don't really get confirmation either way.
No.
So my interpretation was always that it was kind of a combination of them being quite young and the other servants fucking with them. Mm. But
I'm
really interested, actually, by the DID reading, because I've never sort of seen a reading like that before, so it's really, really interesting.
Yeah,
because like that would imply that the altars at this point in time don't share a lot of memory,
Which would make sense, I think, because they've got no real communication with any of them at this point, apart from Shannon.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I feel that perhaps has changed based on the person that we see in 1986.
Mm.
But I would say that the relationship between the altars has also massively changed because the ways that, for example, we've talked about the change in Shannon's personality.
Yeah.
I also feel like, you know, whether the person that we see fronting the most evolves into Canon, or whether Canon's a completely separate thing, Canon's definitely got a different personality to the person we see fronting all the time.
I think it's also really interesting in this scene where Sayo talks about, like, they start talking to the empty air, like, addressing Beatrice, but it's not until they, like, move their mind's eye behind their own head and can look around the chapel that they actually see Beatrice. And I'm like, that's a really typical, like, stereotypical description of dissociation. Is like being able to look down on yourself. So I don't know if that was intentional either, but that seemed like another little kind of thing. I was like, oh, maybe this Beatrice is like another part, another altar that's turning up and being like, I'll be your friend, but I'm a tricksy little witch.
I'm going on very limited interactions with people with DID and little to no research. But is it true that sometimes people have like a mental world? Like systems can have like a mental world? Because that would also make sense as to why like the altars can see manifestations of like multiple of them at the same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hesitant to draw a line straight to the Golden Land, so I'm not going to investigate that too far, but that's fun.
Yeah, I think
so. The next day, I think, they're talking to Kumisawa about it, and she suggests that they kind of start tying things like a spider web to their clothes. So to tying the keys like with some string, with the string being like a spider web to ward off the witch.
Yeah, it's presented also, like, entirely as a ritual rather than a logical solution.
And basically this is where some of the evil spirit mythos gets integrated with the Beatrice mythos.
Mm-hmm.
At least in Sayo's head.
There's another one as well that I think Kumisawa's like, oh yeah, you can tie stuff to yourself, and then also like whenever you have an object in your hand, think about where it lives, like where's its home, personify it so that you like you won't lose it because it has feelings and stuff like that. And I think it's interesting. It's a really clever idea, I think, from Kumisawa, because like Sayo, like, obviously really believes in the witch and has talked about her a lot. So this is, like, giving practical advice without invalidating, without just saying, Sayo, you lose things all the time and that's your fault, so here are some ideas to get around it.
Yeah.
But it may have had some knock-on effects that Kumisawa didn't necessarily think about, because it really...
It's like the priest and Maria all over again.
Yeah, it really cements that this stuff is true. And... like Sayo like relies on these things and then is like, oh, this is super helpful, like the witch is real because it's responding to these rituals that I'm doing. And they have a little conversation with Gap Triche about like what you're gonna do now, you can't take all my stuff in black holes anymore, haha.
They even managed to show up one of the older servants thanks to this method, and they see it as like Gap Triche getting her revenge
on somebody else. I also like it's really interesting when you look at like Sayo has been like, it's said in the narrative basically Sayo has had no friends basically throughout their entire life. It's really fucking sad. Like the only person who would speak to them at the orphanage was the director, and it is established that they were both, I don't know, I'm presuming Christian, but I don't actually know. It doesn't say what religion, but they believed in angels and demons. And we're talking about, like, ways to see angels and ward off demons and stuff. And then Kumisawa is basically the only other person that Sayo's ever had a close relationship with. And she also, at least, I don't know whether she actually believes in all of the ghost stories, but she loves telling them and, like, making other people believe them. And so I'm like, it totally makes sense that basically their two parental figures in their life both believing in supernatural forces would have a big effect on how you saw the world. It's all starting to come together a little bit here.
Kind of trying to adjusting my glasses, getting really excited by the word ritual, because that's a archaeology fucking hot topic word, where like it's sort of a bit of a meme amongst archaeologists that like everything gets assigned a ritual.
Anything that isn't really understood,
it's often like, oh no, it's ritual. But the when you boil it down, like brushing your teeth is a ritual.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the idea is like it's something that you do repeatedly to have a cause and effect. This is something that I like cover a lot in my like research. It's like where does magic begin and end? Because if you do something over and over again, does it takes on a quality of like ritual that is perhaps beyond, you know, it's like if you have a going to bed routine and then you don't do that routine, you can't sleep, and is that because of a like higher purpose of the routine, whether that's like an actual spiritual or magical effect or whether that's a psychological one, and like actually is magic just like, oh, we're dipping our swords in we're dipping our swords in whey because we believe it makes it poisonous. Yeah. And actually like it is, because you're infecting all the your enemies because your sword blade's manky, but they're like, oh, it's magic.
Yeah.
And it's like there's an interesting line between that and what's going on here about like,
mm-hmm,
there is a confirmation like, oh okay, this is a ritual, but it is the mundane, this is brushing your teeth, this is tying a key to your wrist, you know.
Mm. And it's about what meaning you ascribe to that.
Right. There is an interesting I don't want to say dichotomy, because I don't think they are actually separate things, but there is an interesting dynamic here to be that it's fun that Ryukishi is exploring that, and I do appreciate that from him.
It's also confirmed in this bit that Kumasawa also knows the secret about who Sayo is.
So it sounds like those three were the ones who were...
Yeah, yeah, which is interesting, really, because imagine being in a position where you're looking after this kid and you're telling them about the legend of Beatrice, even though you know that the real Beatrice was their mum and grandmother. Like, it's an interesting one. Not sure how to feel about that particularly.
And again, I don't think they quite intended it to go in the direction it ended up going.
Yeah, I think Genji, Kumasawa and Nanjo all massively underestimated quite how fucked up this child was gonna be. And that's on them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because look at their life, oh my god.
So one of the other things that Kumasawa and Sayo bonded over was mystery novels.
Yeah. Kumasawa's also a huge mystery novel fan. Like, there are so many of them in this book, and they just haven't told us about this until right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
big fan of And Then There Were None. By the way, you know, like, the twist mystery novel fan reveal? This isn't just Tsurumi Neko. He does this in Higurashi as well. It's one of his favorite tricks, is to just pull out and be like, by the way, this character, huge mystery novel fan. Like, what? Okay.
It's gonna end up being like we rewrite. Like, imagine going back to episode one and everyone dies, and then Kumasawa's like, oh no, this is horrible. Actually, this reminds me of this book, though, that where this happened. And everyone's like, oh, maybe it's because this is like that book where that thing happened. Imagine how much easier it could have been.
God.
Wild.
All the fucking Yushiromiya family servants like sat around in the servant room watching fucking Glass Onion scratching their heads.
Being like, but we're on an island.
Full of rich people. Shit!
Yeah.
Basically, Sayo kind of reframes And Then There Were None as a game between a human and a witch.
Yeah. Gee,
that sounds familiar.
It's interesting, it's isn't it?
Yeah. It's a, like, Gap Triche is there and is like, I'm the witch, UN Owen. If you can't work out that, like, if you can't figure out how I did it, then I've won and it was magic.
It's, yeah. I think, like, I saw this as basically, Gap Triche got bored, because, so basically my DID theory, it, like, basically involves the, Sayo kind of switching to being Gap Triche at certain points. Gap Triche was hiding their shit, or moving their shit, and then switching back so that Sayo couldn't find it. Now that Sayo has stuff tied to them and knows where things go, Gap Triche's got nothing to do. So yeah. She turns up when Sayo's reading and is like, what am I going to do now? You're just reading all the time. What are you, like, I'm so bored. And Sayo's like, well, talk about this book with me. And yeah, Gap's like, oh, well, if you don't work out what happens by the time that you get to the end, then I win. So we're going to fight about it. I'm not sure what Gap gets out of this, honestly.
You know, Gap's just passing the time.
Gap just really likes to be an adversary to somebody, I think.
Same.
I'd also forgotten that the end of And Then There Were None has the solution in a message in a bottle, which is all very neat, isn't it? Yes, how Umen Echo is done. What were you going to say, Rowan?
Nah, I just had a moment where I realised, okay, so Gap is also Beato, which makes me believe that, like, okay, so how many of the demons are also Beato? Like, is Ronave also Beato?
Maybe.
Is Vigilia, or... because Vigilia's Beato, but is that...
I think by the end of Umen Echo, it's going to turn out that literally every single person is Beatrice. There's just one person on this island having a massive breakdown.
I'm like, oh, okay.
Same.
Which suddenly, I'm screaming and bashing my head against the desk because every ship becomes incest.
I mean, there weren't that many left in the first place, but now it's all of them.
God, the Mortal Instruments fandom is quaking in its boots. Your favourite ship is secretly incest. Pick any ship you like, we'll do it.
Incredible.
God.
Oh,
pour one out for the two George Shannon shippers.
It's important to acknowledge, by the way, right at the end of this, that Sayo loses this game.
Oh yes, Sayo
Gap wins. And Then There Were None. What? No, what?
Because George Sayo is still incest.
Yeah.
And so's Jessica Gaddis.
Yep. Yeah. No. Like all of them are incest now. All of them.
Oh my god, are the stakes...
Basically, the only people we can ship now are the servants, not counting Sayo.
Yeah, don't worry, your Genji, Nanjo, Kinzo, Fick is still fine.
Yeah. We've got, there's two options in Umen Echo. You either ship incest, or you ship characters you hate, or both. That's it. Enjoy.
Oh my god.
You're just having a moment there.
Every time I sort of like draw more dots in this book, it really upsets me.
I do feel like at least they didn't know it was incest.
Yeah.
I will, however, say that the fact that Sayo is actually 3 years older than they know they are does not let George off the hook at all.
No, basically.
Just so you know, George.
We can't put George on the hook for incest, but we can keep George on the hook for being creepy.
Right, because George doesn't know this, and also I don't think it becomes an acceptable age gap even with a 3-year addition.
It's definitely
it's
better,
weird.
But it's not good. And the servant employee kind of thing going on is still no.
How old is George?
23.
Okay, at 23 years old, I feel weird following someone 19 on Twitter.
I don't think it's out of the question, but it certainly can't be your servant.
Yeah, it's not your servant. It's definitely not like your servant who's still going to like non-university school, I think is a bit weird.
Yeah.
Nope.
So
that's a child.
And there was also a moment as well. I don't think we discussed it in the last reading, but it was established in the last reading that Anja has like quite a poor constitution and is quite like sickly a lot of the time, and so is George. Yeah. And this seems to be something that like kind of runs in the Ashuramir family a bit, and Sayo's the same. I'm like linked.
Yeah, they can bond over being sickly, I guess.
Bond over their hereditary poor immune systems.
Yeah.
Imagine if they all fucking had polydactyly and they're like, George and Shannon get married, and then, you know, they're hanging out on the beach for the first time, and George is like, damn, I didn't know you had six toes. That's how they figured it out.
I don't want Sayo to turn out to have more toes as well. We've got enough toes in this fic. Anyway, next chapter.
I think
yes. The old servants leave, and new servants come in, but the new servants don't really seem to like respect the witch mythos
or Sayo. So, really?
No.
So Sayo kind of puts the fear of witches in them. It's presented as Sayo being possessed by Gap Triche to do this this act of magic.
I'm willing to put a point under Jess's theory at this moment.
Looking
at it now, it lines up quite well with the DID theorizing. This is really interesting. And Sayo manages to do this thing, which is taking one key off the servant's master key keychain and then putting it in their locker later.
Yeah, and it's all supposed to be impossible because literally that servant, who is, it's Belphegor, in a hat, and the other one's Asmodeus in a hat. Yeah, her back's turned, but she's like right next to the keychain, and it's loud and it's noisy and it's really stiff, so it'd be hard to get one key off at the at a time. And then they were together the entire time up until that servant found the key in their locker. So it was like, how would it have been possible? So it's like, I think Asmodeus like doesn't really believe in the witch, but Belphegor's like fucking terrified.
Yeah.
And Sayo just fucking loves feeling the power like having made someone believe. Personally, I think this is quite easy to work out. I did first, I was just like, maybe they're just underestimating how quick and quiet this kid can be. But I was like, actually, this turns out quite simple if you like, it was established in the earlier scene that all of their master key rings look identical because they couldn't tell from sight which one Genji was holding. They had to all check their pockets. So I was like, okay, all Sayo had to do was take a master key off their own key ring earlier, switch the two key rings, and have already planted their own key in that girl's locker. And then that becomes the impossible locked room thing. But pretty good for what at this point is what? Like, how old are they now? 10? Who knows?
Like 10. Well, maybe 11. 13, but they think they're 10.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, I was not pulling this shit at 13. I was making fucking codes to make my friends guess who I had a crush on, and they were nowhere near as good as this.
That's so good.
Shit, have I not mentioned this before?
Can you send me some of those?
I don't want to
work out who you have a crush on.
I can't believe I've not mentioned this on podcast.
No, you haven't.
So, when I was like 13, 14 at school, everybody had their top five, was like the top five people that they have a crush on. I was completely uninterested in this, but what I realised is that I loved people trying to guess my top five. So I arbitrarily assigned five random people from the school and then made a quiz, like a mystery essentially, that was extremely complicated and convoluted in order to like lead them eventually to guessing who these five people were. And you had to have such like tiny esoteric knowledge that I was like dropping left, right and center. I felt good about it at the time. I had a great time.
It was a scavenger hunt for your crushes.
Yeah. I've compared Umineko to this because the like level of convoluted it was like, okay, so this person's nickname is Yeti because it's this person who I know has really big feet, and it was like you have to know the size of,
and it was also toe big.
I can't believe it. Not again.
you have to know Imran's shoe size in order to guess who Bigfoot is. But if you know, I'm like, one of the clues is like Yeti is best friends with blah, and then it's like, oh, if you can figure out who that is and you know these two people are best friends, and you can also this way figure it out. Anyway, it was insane and convoluted. And I have, talking to other people, I suppose, not on pod, compared Umineko to this insane ritual I made when I was 14, 15. Tell me
you're queer and neurodivergent without telling me you're queer and neurodivergent.
I was prepping to become an insane DM.
Yeah.
Like,
this is
just me training to be, like, really good at Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
Yeah, insane. No, but yeah, no. Nowhere near as good as this trick, but also, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of road backstory if you've made it this far.
Yeah, I love that. Treat. And to be fair, Saya had a lot of time where they weren't doing anything else. And they had read a lot of detective novels. Already.
I think
so
that probably does help.
Yeah.
Yeah. After this whole experience, they're like so excited by this. And they decide that they'd rather be a witch than a servant.
We get this scene twice in this chapter, essentially. Like, we get the retelling by the servant of what she thought happened. But we also get Sayo's witch perspective on what happened, where they basically, like, Gap takes over their body. They can't move anymore. Mm-hmm. It's very dissociation. It's very switching alters or whatever. Gap, like, levitates the master key into the air, takes one off, uses all the magic, and Sayo feels, like, so fucking powerful after having done that, and, like, really excited, and is, like, yeah, it's basically, like, my ideal before now was Shannon, and now my ideal is a witch.
Yeah. New gender envy unlocked. Something I want to just bring up just now while we're talking about Beato. I've been going through and looking at Claire's sprites a little bit, and at least on the PS3 release, she's got the exact same face shape as Beato.
Yeah.
And she, her sprites, like her base standing sprite, is the like glassy-eyed doll Beato that we got.
I clocked that, I think. And Claire's not really involved in any of this still at this point. She's narrating. When we go back to the theater bit, she's narrating as if she is Sayo. But other than that, like, it's really unclear what her actual relevance is to do with any of this. Until.
So, yeah. So they're kind of rearranging the witch mythos to support a witch universe with Sayo as a witch, basically. They come up with spider webs and mirrors as a weakness. Specifically, mirrors, because they hate how they look. So that's interesting.
Yeah, they specifically say that whenever they look in the mirror, they see their, like, pathetic... They see Yasu, who they hate being and they don't want to be seen as, which is interesting.
Completely unrelatable. Don't know what the fuck you're on about.
Yeah.
Whenever I look in a mirror, I just flex. I'm like fucking Gaston.
Good grief.
And they sort of end up separating themselves from the Shannon. I guess Shannon persona, sort of. Where now the lore is that Shannon just has always been by herself and never had anyone else in the room. And now that the Sayo has become this witch. Also, Sayo takes Gab's pronouns.
She's like, I'm Beatrice now. I'm taking your name. I'm taking your pronouns. I'm redesigning the look. And you just stay there now. You're my friend.
Yeah, they don't actually have a name for Gap yet. So
she's like, I'll think of one.
It's just like Beato's friend who speaks like a sort of like cool older sister.
Yeah. So
which is how Gap speaks when we see when her.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
it's the same stuff.
I loved this because basically I saw this, you know, you were mentioning about inner world stuff earlier, Owen. They do all of this restructuring of their personalities in the backdrop that's going on is like the Sea of Fragments one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, like I read this as like they've retreated to their Sea of Fragments inner world to do a bit of alter switch it up. They are like, okay, cool. Shannon's the host now. Shannon's the everyday person who we're going to put out basically all the time. She's got to take over and do all of our everyday boring servant duties we don't want anything to do with anymore. Sayo's like, I'm going to basically delete Yasu. And I'm going to be a witch now. And my name is Beatrice. And it's kind of unclear what kind of happens to that altar. Like, it's they kind of say like Shannon's daytime and then Beatrice is nighttime. It's not confirmed in any of this reading whether like Shannon does anything at night apart from sleep. So I don't know whether this Beatrice is actually comes out at any point during the night or whether it's like mostly an internal kind of thing where they're thinking about magic and stuff.
The implication I always got was because sometimes the servants do stay overnight on the island, especially Sayo because they have to go to school.
Yeah.
So I assumed that they'd switch over to their witch persona and start, you know, just doing some small
unlocking
tricks.
Windows, maybe.
Yeah.
Little thing called trickery.
Yeah, stuff like that.
That was the implication I always got, is a sort of like way of affirming their existence.
But yeah, I kind of saw this them really coming into this Beatrice part of themselves as like a reaction to realizing they could have power over someone. Because like that feeling of having tricked someone into believing that they were a witch is the first time anyone's ever believed them about anything. They've ever felt like they had any control or power over anything. So I was like, okay, it makes complete sense why you would take that in as part of yourself. But also, you've still got to be a servant in the daytime, so you've got to kind of keep it a bit separate to your working everyday stuff. interestingly enough, like, Shannon's never talked to Beatrice. So those, Shannon as the new host seems completely unaware that Beatrice is there. Mm-hmm. It's like they say they
which
wipe their memory
up with
or whatever.
What we're presented with, with Shannon when we see her in the main game boards.
Yeah. Oh, another thing is that the Beatrice that Sayo creates looks like Claire.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Which is why the description in the character menu confuses me so much. Because, like, the Claire Beatrice doesn't seem to me like someone with no personality and is just a tool. It seems like a part of Yasu. Maybe, I guess, like, it could just be a kind of a personality that allows for magic and stuff. But, yeah, like, apart from how she looks like... Apart from what she looks like, she seems like the original Beatrice, like the elder Beatrice to me, rather than just a tool.
Well, we still have some time to explore.
That's
Claire,
true. That's
so,
true.
I think we'll some stuff might click into place a bit. Yes.
Oh.
So
poor Sion.
That kind of wraps up our reading with. You know, this new setup, Shannon the lonely servant, Beatrice the witch and her unnamed friend. So, yeah. It's sort of, I think already you can kind of see how the tragedy is going to end up
it's,
kind of playing
It's
out.
Coming together a little bit, like the motivations and the grounding of like what this character believes. And how, like, what their knowledge base is, as well, is really coming together.
I will say, this just fully cements the motivation for wanting to murder the servants.
Yeah, fully.
As well as everyone else in the house.
I also, like, this was hard to read. It was so sad. I wanted so much better for this character. Like, they didn't deserve any of this.
Yeah, I'm gonna put a pin here. I'm not unless something happens that makes me go feral about it, which, you know, Umineko sure has a track record of doing that. I'm gonna say this once. I fucking adore Jess's interpretation. This is this fucking bangs. This fits a lot with like things I've been thinking about in relation to this and so forth. Like I'm fully behind it. It is kind of it does feel somewhat sad and somewhat cliche to have like, oh, the killer was someone with DID all along.
That's why I think that it's gonna have to be handled really well in the later bits of how the motivation and the backstory and things come in. Because I think, like, I think there's definitely potential for it to not look like that. But you have, like, there's a definite, like, there's a line.
Yeah.
I will say I have a completely different read on Sayo.
Okay.
Not to discount your read. I think it's really interesting. But I can't. It's going to become more apparent in later readings.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to hear, when we get to a point where you're ready to share it, I'm really interested to hear your take, because everything Jess is saying at the moment, like, yeah, this makes sense to things I've been thinking about. So I'm interested to hear another take. Yeah. Don't know that I'm interested in positioning myself as like, yeah, I'm the arbiter of what's good and bad representation of DID, but
yeah.
I'm also dubious of, like, it. So far in sort of cinema and books and whatever, the only stories I've heard about people with DID have all been...
Ooh, crazy murderer,
dangerous.
Whatever. Like, yeah.
Right.
I think that's it's already very different in that they're exploring this as a deep trauma narrative and stuff, and presumably one that isn't necessarily completely motivated by revenge, because we got that red truth that one time. Like, I think it depends on how it goes.
I will say, I would struggle to come up with a read on Sayo as a character that's not, at least in some form, neurodivergent.
Yeah, that's completely fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think no matter what read you have on this character, they're definitely neurodiverse.
But yeah, I'm intrigued to find out. I think it's just, like, I've been thinking about my own dissociation and stuff a lot recently, so that reading jumped out at me because it's been there were a lot of parallels with things I'd been thinking about. I don't know how I'd have read it, and also because I was like, well, the witch's cling is clearly unreal, so what real world explanation are we looking for here? I was like determined to explain this somehow, so I'd be interested to find out on other people's.
I will say this is one of the favorite things about my chapter, is about this, like, episode in general, is that yes, we're being given a sort of backstory, but we're not being just handed
it's a biased
it.
Backstory.
We have to kind
still...
of yeah, we have to kind of piece it together still.
Yeah, it's interesting. Omineko, I remain dubious of the set of circumstances that led Sayo to be in the situation that they're in, but I think the response to that situation is turning out to be quite skillfully observed. So although it is like I'm kind of like smashing my head against the keyboard, what the fuck is going on about a lot of the like Kinzo based antics, a lot of the like other stuff, I'm like, okay, this is like interestingly observed account of the ways that trauma can affect a person.
Yeah, it's difficult to read. Like it's emotionally hard hitting, definitely.
This is clearly somebody who has dealt with a lot of people with trauma, and as a consequence has a good idea of how that would
manifest.
Don't think it makes him a good writer still. I think he's just writing about what he knows, and so it's a little bit stronger.
You're like, no inch, no bit of slack for Ryukishi.
No. I refuse.
Do we have time for an epitaph corner?
It's a
quick one because I don't have any ideas left.
Yes, because Courtney needs to cut out my Voldemort rant at the start, so we can find out the end of the episode.
Yeah, let's go for it. Let's do an epitaph corner. Why not?
Welcome to Jess's Epitaph Corner.
Okay, so this is I've cobbled together various things to create a narrative. None of this solves anything, but imagine, if we will, that the epitaph is told from Beatrice's perspective, and it's the Beatrice that Kinzo knew, that he fell in love with. Her beloved homeland is Italy.
Oh, that's powerful.
The journey that is happening is the journey from Italy to Japan in a submarine.
That's about it.
I feel like I'm sticking by my interpretation that the gouging bits of the epitaph are about poking different bits of the lion statues near the chapel. They're statues, they face in a certain direction. I feel like once you've done all of these different bits of poking the lion statues, one of them turns round and points in a different direction. Maybe the one behind the chapel that we got, you know, noted about. I don't know where, because this is when Erica and Battler solved the epitaph. Battler was like, that wasn't pointing the same way before. And they were outside and they'd just finished the gouging bit. And so I was like, yeah, one of the lion statues turns around, it points them in a direction, it points them to the shrine, which is actually the entrance to the tunnels. And like, that's why Shannon didn't send Maria to it, because I'm stealing your idea that Shannon has solved the epitaph.
Mm. No, that's chill.
And that was the... that whole thing of her going to the shrine and smashing the spirit mirror was actually her going to the shrine, having solved the epitaph and getting into the tunnels. And and the tunnels lead back to the submarine, which they put the gold in because they were like, I can't move this. Let's just put it fucking back in the submarine. The submarine's probably still there. Like, it epitomizes the whole journey. It's about everything. It's in the submarine. Solved.
Hell yeah.
Epitaph over.
You know what?
We did it. We'll fucking take it.
Do you have any red truths to deny that, Courtney?
I'm going to hold my cards, I think.
That's, yes, so many.
Remains unchallenged. This is the correct interpretation.
Yeah. They're just poking, like, that's what they should have done, is they should have gone around the chapel. They should have been poking different bits of the lions.
As one would if one was poking, just for like, a small broom, like
poking the lions in the eyes.
They should have taken a leaf out of Leon's book and just pinched the lion's ass and see if anything happened.
That's the singular trait that has been carried over between the two.
The 11th Twilight, pinch the lion's ass.
Goodness me.
Oh, you wanna watch powerful. What a powerful epitaph.
Robin Hood and I get to the end.
I don't know.
He kind of bad though.
If Beatrice's homeland is Italy, I don't know what the sweet fish is. It's her sweet lips. That Kinzo wants
Witch
to smooch.
Witch lips!
It's the river of all the burnt pasta that she keeps making.
Oh, starchy water.
Starchy burnt pasta water, it's delicious. Beautiful.
I feel like I'm getting closer every time I do this. I don't.
You are. I don't know.
You're definitely onto something.
Whether it's right.
Cohesive answer today, which is quite nice.
Yeah, like this is the point. Problem with the epitaph is that, like, I don't know what the epitaph. What does solving the epitaph mean? Does it point you to the location of the gold? Does it tell you the truth of Umineko and what's going on with Beatrice? Like, I don't know what the answer is. Like,
I think it's the location of the gold because it's like, I think it's still in universe what Kinzo wrote.
That is what I am presuming, but, like, I don't actually know. And I don't know whether the bit where it's, like, blah, blah, resurrection of all of the dead people and the reuniting of love, that whole section, I don't know if that has anything to do with anything.
Was it just for flavour?
Is it just random witch nonsense to put us off the scent? Is the gold actually buried in, like, Beatrice's tomb, and, like,
incredible.
Who knows? You find her there. Yeah. She's dead. There's a coffin full of gold.
Like, really skillfully done, like, foiled gold roses.
But, like, that is a question. Like, what did they do with the younger Beatrice's body? Because she didn't, like, legitimately exist as far as anyone was aware. So, like, did they send her off to sea? Did they bury her somewhere in Rokkanjima? Did they?
Probably buried her somewhere in Rokkanjima because it's mostly uncultivated. No one would know.
Fill her full of gold? Who knows?
Well, it depends. What do you think happened to all the bodies of everyone, of all the soldiers?
They're all in the submarine as well. They build a new submarine out of bones.
A golden submarine.
I hate that. Anyway, our next reading, for those of us reading along, is chapter 13, A New Element. Chapter 15, Sprout of Love, Root of Love. Ooh, ooh.
As a final closing note for our dear listeners, another peep behind the mirror into Rowan Land, I've realised I've got spaghetti and meatballs for dinner tonight.
Don't ban them.
I think if I eat them, I may solve the epitaph.
I have not done all of this work over all of these weeks for you to solve the epitaph, but you spaghetti and meatballs, okay?
I just go into a fugue state and figure it out. Nah, I had my one good attempt. I did a bit of maths.
You finish your bowl of spaghetti and meatballs and there's a bunch of gold at the bottom and you're like,
I'm gonna never forget Courtney fandom spot
for the rest of my life.
Ounce for the last time.
Ounce for the last time.
Oh my goodness.
We're gonna find it. The like actual answer, and it's gonna be like, you see this bit where there's like 9 syllables in this bit, and then you times it by how many lines there are here, and it makes a cube. And then I'm like, this was numbers, and I hated it.
It was a numbies game the whole time.
Someone said that at one point, and I've not been engaging with that side of it because that's not my jam.
I respect that massively.
So I've just been trying to avoid numbers and hope that it's actually not anything to do with that.
Yeah, one can hope.
So our social media is all under the description as per usual. For more epitaph shenanigans, go follow the pod Tumblr. And unless we have anything else, I believe we will wrap up there.
Behold, the sweet fish river running through my hometown. You seek the golden land, follow through the path down the stream in search of the key. As you travel
down, as you travel down
into a village.
It just keeps going. It won't end.
Courtney and all Italians experience a microaggression.
Oh my gosh.
There sleeps the key to the golden land.
I guess you can never meet my dad again.
R.A.P. Clive. Life sent to the golden land.
Clive is an extremely Italian name, by the way.
He's half Italian, it's fine.
I'm stopping the recording there.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, thank you and good night. Please don't do this.